This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents After the Fall, Being American in the World We've Made. This is the author, Ben Rhodes. For my family, and for people battling authoritarianism everywhere. The final takeover does not happen with one spectacular Reichstag conflagration, but is instead an excruciating, years-long process of many scattered, seemingly insignificant little fires that smolder without flames. Eche Temelkurin. Prologue. Once there was a nation that ascended to a position of preeminence unparalleled in history. This nation held within its hands the capacity to destroy, shape, and enlighten all human life on Earth. Its position of preeminence was reached after what seemed like an inexorable rise. Born in revolution, built in part by the toil of those who suffered the lash of the whip, preserved through the crucible of civil war, populated by immigrants from everywhere, enlarged through the brutal conquest of a continental frontier, enhanced by great feats of engineering and ingenuity, validated by the defeat of fascist ideologies that subjugated people half a world away, and the extension of civil rights at home. The expansion of this nation's influence was for a time contained by the barrier of an alternative form of human organization, communism. When the wall that symbolized this barrier came down, it was as if a dam had broken, allowing a great flood to water the soil on the other side. New markets would create wealth that people had been denied. Unmatched military strength would maintain peace among nations. Technological innovation would raise standards of living and make all human knowledge accessible to people everywhere. The people themselves would live in the freedom guaranteed by democracy, the uncorrupted government of, by, and for the people, the inevitable endpoint of history. To be born American in the late 20th century was to take the fact of a particular kind of American exceptionalism as granted, a state of nature arrived at after all else had failed. In the span of just 30 years, this assumption would come crashing down. Ironically, once they were unbridled, the very forces that enabled this nation's rise would accelerate its descent. The globalized spread of profit-seeking capitalism accelerated inequality, assaulted people's sense of traditional identity, and seeded a corruption that allowed those with power to consolidate control. After the attacks of September 11, 2001, this nation's sense of purpose was channeled into a forever war that hemorrhaged resources, propagated a politics of us versus them, and offered a template and justification for autocratic leaders who represented an older form of nationalism. This nation's new technologies proliferated like an uncontrolled virus before we understood their impact, transforming the way that human beings consume information, at first hopeful. The unifying allure of the internet and social media segmented people back into lonely tribes where they could be more easily manipulated by propaganda, disinformation, and conspiracy theory. Somehow, after three decades of unchecked American capitalism, military power, and technological innovation, the currents of history had turned against democracy itself, bringing back those older forms of nationalism and social control in new packaging. To be American in 2020 was to live in a country diminished in the world, unwilling to control the spread of disease or face up to our racism, and looking over the precipice of abandoning the very democracy that was supposed to be the solid core of our national identity. Understanding how that happened is the starting point to figuring out how to move forward. America itself is a nation that encompasses the multitudes of humanity, a country populated with all of humanity's contradictions, hypocrisies, and opposing impulses. having been humbled by our own excesses and salvaged by the narrow escape of the 2020 election, America has an opportunity to step back into history as a nation with a new understanding of how to improve upon the world we made. To do so, we have to recreate an identity that draws on our better history as a nation of outsiders, reflexively distrustful of power, joined together to do big things, united by a set of principles that allows each of us to be whoever we want to be, regardless of tribe. That is what we owe the world and ourselves. After the fall, we must determine what it means to be American again. I set out to write this book in the wake of the Obama presidency so that I could understand what happened to the world, my country, and myself. After working for 8 years at the height of American political power, I felt like an exile in my own country. It was a newly disorienting reality, and one that lent itself to questioning every assumption I had as an American. Travel was the most comforting and illuminating escape I could make from the political chaos back home. I took every opportunity I could to go overseas, and I found myself seeking out the kind of people I never really had the opportunity to fully know when I was in government. Dissidents, activists, oppositionists, anyone really who looked at power from the perspective of an outsider. What an opportunity to learn the stories of individuals who lived the political trends that I had watched from the exalted distance of the White House. Unburdened by being American themselves, they experienced no difficulty of politeness or discomfort that prevented them from seeing the Trump years for what they were, an American experiment with fascism, albeit of a particularly incompetent and corrupt kind. But there was also a similarly obvious reality. The forces that produced a Trump presidency long predated it and would still be there after it was over. Indeed, a new model of nationalist authoritarian politics is a defining reality of our world today. The more I investigated this phenomenon, trying to work it out for myself, the more I saw the fingerprints of the era of American hegemony on what was shaping the lives of people all around me, how the 2008 financial crisis had collapsed not only the global economy, but also confidence in the very fact of American-led globalization, opening the door to deeply familiar nationalist appeals, how the post-9/11 wars had also discredited American leadership while opening the door to a hyper-securitized politics of us versus them, one that could easily be repurposed to target an available other in country after country, how the spread of social media had unleashed a flood of disinformation that undermined democracy, while offering autocrats ever more powerful tools of social and political control. I saw this most clearly in three countries that were communist throughout the Cold War and are at the center of the political forces remaking the world today. In Hungary, where the anti-communist liberal turned reactionary nationalist Viktor Orban took advantage of the 2008 financial crisis to create a model of authoritarian politics that is strikingly similar to the playbook that the Republican Party has run in America. In Russia, where Vladimir Putin capitalized upon the humiliations of the end of the Cold War to build a cabal anchored in corruption and nationalism, and then set out to turn the United States into a mirror image, with American social media as his most potent offensive weapon. And in China, where Xi Jinping is building the model for a new world order on the pillars of state-controlled capitalism, national sovereignty, and totalitarian technology. Remove any democratic values, and you get the shift from the recent American model to the emerging Chinese one. This is a book of stories, based on the instinct that it is best to see global events through the perspective of individual lives. The Hungarian opposition, searching for a democratic identity capable of overcoming the blood and soil nationalism of the past and the failure of globalization to deliver on its promise. The Russians, who have been victimized by violence and are still insisting on a politics cleansed of corruption, anchored in the truth. The Hong Kong protesters, who saw a freedomless, capitalist, techno-totalitarian future encroaching upon their city, and launched a movement that should be heard as a cry of warning. Collectively, their stories allowed me to see more clearly what had happened in their countries and why, as well as to see the myriad ways that the era of American hegemony had contributed to it. That, in turn, allowed me to see America more clearly, through the eyes of outsiders in other countries, and through my own experience of being an outsider at home. Ultimately, this book is my story, my journey from the wake of a historic presidency to a world that looked at America and saw that presidency's opposite, my effort to relearn what it means to be an American in a world gone wrong. While I was writing this book, a Russian who is a leading character in it was poisoned and nearly killed. The Hong Kong protest I immersed myself in were snuffed out. The world went on lockdown in the face of a pandemic, and an American autocrat was voted out of office and sought to overturn the result. Through these dramatic developments, the currents of history that I was feeling around me remained constant. If anything, the picture became clearer and clearer, like a landscape from which fog is lifting. Because this book represents my own experience of these things, it is inevitably incomplete. We are all inherently limited in our perspective, shaped by our own history. But by recognizing ourselves in others, we can expand our own lens of vision. Perhaps we can also see our own shortcomings more clearly. For me, the experience of looking into the eye of where America has gone wrong has only made me love more fiercely what America is supposed to be. That is the starting point of my present journey. Part 1. The Authoritarian Playbook. We can never start a new life. We can only continue the old one. Imre Kertész. 1. The Currents of History. From the moment I was deposited back into civilian life after the Trump inauguration, I felt compelled to get away from what was happening in America. To emerge bleary-eyed from some international flight, change currency in the baggage claim, and walk into blinding sunlight and the cacophony of voices speaking another language along the curbside. Men, smoking in soccer jerseys, clustered around a metal pole. Was to be reminded that life went on, despite the sense of hostage-taking that afflicted my homeland. It was a form of self-imposed exile. And yet, in each locale, there was the discovery that the same thing was happening everywhere. In March 2017, I went to Myanmar to help the government there prepare for peace negotiations with a patchwork of provincial ethnic groups who had been waging civil war for decades. Diplomacy, it turned out, was privatized like everything else. I would be an independent contractor for a British-based non-governmental organization, NGO, led by Jonathan Powell, who had served as chief of staff for Tony Blair. Powell had led the negotiations to secure the Good Friday Accords that secured peace in Northern Ireland in the late 90s. Ever since, he'd become something of a globe-trotting private peacemaker from Africa to Latin America to Southeast Asia, a figure out of a Graham Greene novel, meeting rebels in jungles and deserts, seeking to recapture the accomplishment of his career's high-water mark. Perhaps because I was newly admitted into the ranks of former officials, it seemed no surprise to Powell or his staff that I wanted to get to Burma a little early to unwind. We were trying to help end wars, but we were also dealing with our own private ones. For a couple of days, I walked aimlessly around the sprawling city of Yangon, a blanket of heavy heat over me, buying knockoff Nikes for a few bucks to make it easier on my feet. I went to a pagoda and sat staring at a Buddha, waiting to feel something. I walked into a U.S. government-funded library where I'd been a guest of honor a couple of years before. Now, anonymous to young Burmese buried in books and screens. Then I conducted workshops in the capital city of Naypyidaw to help the Myanmar negotiating team prepare, sharing lessons I'd learned while negotiating reconciliation between the United States and Cuba. The civilians took earnest, copious notes. The stern-faced military men in drab green uniforms wrote nothing down. Afterward, I joined a meeting with Aung San Suu Kyi, dissident turned state counselor, at her residence. For the first time in my several meetings with her, we were asked to take off our shoes inside the Buddhist home, a reminder of the Burmese Buddhist nationalism that had become more predominant in recent years. Within a matter of months, the Burmese military that had once imprisoned Suu Kyi would pursue a campaign of ethnic cleansing against a Muslim minority, the Rohingya. 1 million people were driven into neighboring Bangladesh. Through it all, Suu Kyi would remain silent. People wondered at her fall, from Nobel Peace Laureate of the early 90s to international pariah. But it made a certain kind of sad sense to me. A survivor from a country on the periphery of power in the world. She once surfed the wave of democracy that accompanied the end of the Cold War. She rocketed to international attention in 1989, the year that the Berlin Wall came down, by leading a democratic movement protesting the military government. By 2017, she was doing what she felt she needed to do to survive in a world where nationalism ran amok. Her own journey, from democracy icon to tacit collaborator in brutality fueled by Buddhist nationalism and rampant anti-Rohingya disinformation on Facebook, didn't cut against the currents of history. It drifted in the wake of events and the wider world. In April 2017, I went to Milan with Barack Obama. He was there to speak about climate change, a few weeks after Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. The rhythm of the trip felt familiar. A private plane, a block of hotel rooms, Secret Service agents. But the plane was a fraction the size of Air Force One. There were only a handful of hotel rooms and agents. And unlike the crush of responsibilities that used to follow me, I had very little to do. I accompanied Obama on a private tour of Leonardo da Vinci's drawings, peering down at bold lines that improbably anticipated the machines of the future. Helicopters and missiles, the machinery of war that we'd presided over for 8 years. Dusty volumes, hundreds of years old, lined the walls of the library. From human creations like this, the Renaissance had emerged, paving the way for the pursuit of scientific inquiry and cultivation of a more enlightened Western civilization that now felt under assault. Back at the hotel, throngs of Italians waited outside Obama's hotel. I told him that he remained the most popular politician in the world. No, he corrected me. I'm one of the biggest celebrities in the world now. He didn't mean it as a good thing. Progressive change relegated to cultural celebrity. In July 2017, I went to Cuba. I stayed at the sprawling Hotel Nacional in the heart of Havana. Black and white photos of the Castros with visiting dignitaries and celebrities. Vestiges of Cold War history hung in the lobby. I met a friend from the American Embassy for drinks at the outdoor bar. The kind of place that you assume had been populated by revolutionaries and spies for the last several decades. In a hushed voice, my friend told me about a mysterious illness that had struck employees of the embassy. There were theories about sonic attacks, but the source would never be firmly established. It felt to us like something the Russians might do. People who wanted to sow conflict, drive others apart, put America and Cuba back into the Cold War that I thought we had ended. A couple of days later, I flew to Santiago, where the Cuban Revolution had begun. I felt sicker than I could remember ever having been. A throbbing headache, ringing in the ears, repeatedly, and not always successfully, suppressing the urge to vomit. Was it food poisoning? Or something else? I was shown around the revolutionary sites by an eager guide, a museum that documented the crimes of the pre-revolutionary U.S.-backed Batista government, felt several historical epochs out of date. And so did the Cuban Revolution. I was driven into the countryside, almost 2 hours on roads at times blocked by mangy herds of animals, my stomach doing flips with every bump. We came to a secluded cemetery in the mountains, the place where the revolutionaries had become guerrillas. It was lush and peaceful, the only sounds coming from the birds and the breeze through the trees. An old man who'd fought with the Castros showed me around, his tour culminating at the site where Raul Castro would be buried. I looked at the tomb with Raul's name already etched into it. This was a man who wanted to be remembered in the place where he had been young, when it was all still a cause, uncorrupted by power and the passage of time. Back at the Nacional the next day, I lay on my bed staring at the ceiling and having a conversation in my head. Had we misled all of these people? From the Cubans who wanted to move beyond the past? To the Europeans who saw America as a guarantor of democracy? To the Burmese who wanted democracy for themselves? People who had trusted us, only to be burned. Or were we always pushing against inexorable forces? The hardline Cubans who clung to power with Russian backers? The nationalists trying to unravel the European Union? The Burmese military who wanted a nation for Buddhists? Was the dark turn I sensed everywhere I went a cause of America's nationalist authoritarian turn? Or was America merely following the same turn happening everywhere, caught in the current of history like a piece of driftwood? This question continued to roll around in my head from continent to continent. In Kenya, an American diplomat told me the Chinese were methodically supplanting American influence, buying up businesses and media, courting the students who no longer felt welcome in the United States. In Singapore, a senior government official told me casually over drinks that Asia had moved on from America, speaking as if this gleaming capitalist construction had almost been seamlessly handed off to the Chinese. In Amsterdam, Obama and I toured the empty Anne Frank house at night, peering into the small rooms where she'd penned her diary, the absence of tourists lending the place a feeling of having been forgotten. In country after country, people asked me searching questions about how Trump could have happened. In Europe, Trump was often tied to the British vote for Brexit and the refugee crisis of 2015, the fears of Muslim hordes invading our open societies. But this theory, I felt certain, was wrong. It diminished the more structural, consequential forces at work everywhere I went, forces that had been building for a long time. No. This wasn't some black swan event, easily explained by a couple of years' worth of scary headlines. It ignored the lived reality of the 8 years that I worked in the White House. The feeling that a cancer was metastasizing everywhere, despite our efforts to treat it. It conveniently elided the ways in which decades of American capitalism, technology, and the politicized pursuit of national security had ripened so many people in the United States and around the world for crude nationalist appeals. Then, on an early 2018 trip to Berlin, for an Obama town hall with European youth, I met a young Hungarian named Sándor Lederer. We talked in an empty room of what was once the headquarters of the German Democratic Republic, GDR, a Soviet-backed nation that doesn't exist anymore. The building was built in the drab style of 1960s communist architecture. The exterior was gray and imposing. The interior filled with mosaics depicting idealized scenes of Germans in factories, farms, and mines, contrasted with images of book burning and the persecution of workers under the Nazis. For more than three decades, the men who ruled the GDR with access to the Stasi's files on the private lives of other East German citizens, came to work in this building. It has since become one of Germany's leading business schools, the European School of Management and Technology, ESMT, a name that encapsulates the technocratic ethos of globalization that shaped the beginning of the 21st century. A monument to communist power, turned into a place to train capitalists. A reminder that history never ends. Not yet 40, Sándor had knowing, sunken eyes and a mop of black hair flecked with gray, as if he carried around his country's post-Cold War journey like a weight. I asked him to walk me through how his country's prime minister, Viktor Orbán, had transformed Hungary from an open democracy to a largely authoritarian system in the span of a decade. It took him only a few minutes. Win elections through right-wing populism that taps into people's outrage over the corruption and inequities wrought by unbridled globalization. Enrich corrupt oligarchs who, in turn, fund your politics. Create a vast partisan propaganda machine. Redraw parliamentary districts to entrench your party in power. Pack the courts with right-wing judges and erode the independence of the rule of law. Keep big business on your side with low taxes and favorable treatment. Demonize your political opponents through social media disinformation. Attack civil society as a tool of George Soros. Cast yourself as the sole legitimate defender of national security. Wrap the whole project in a Christian nationalist message that taps into the longing for a great past. Offer a sense of belonging for the disaffected masses. Relentlessly attack the other. Immigrants, Muslims, liberal elites. It struck me that Sándor could have been describing America instead of Hungary. I saw more clearly what had been stirring in me since Trump's inauguration. America wasn't at risk of being transformed into a semi-authoritarian nation by Trump. We were already well along that spectrum, and the damage could not be undone by any single election. And sitting in the old headquarters of the GDR, this monument to the world that America transformed with the end of the Cold War, I began to see the outlines of how America's own actions over the last 30 years made this transformation possible in our own country and in others. This is the world we made. 2. Freedom's High Water Mark. Sándor Lederer was 6 years old when the Berlin Wall was torn down in 1989. His father was a foreign correspondent based in East Berlin, and Sándor remembers the energy of the people in the streets, the excited conversations at the dinner table, the sense that something important was happening all around him, even if he was too young to fully grasp it. After experiencing the euphoria of Berlin's reunification, his family returned to Budapest to find it transforming. As a child, he told me, you see the visuals. Visuals in terms of statues that you see on the streets, street names, cars on the street, billboard advertising, and also what you see on TV, several political parties discussing things. Gone were the traces of Soviet-sponsored totalitarianism, with its stale sameness, communist iconography, and anointed heroes. In its place, suddenly, was the promise of an open society, the freedom to choose what news you watched, what products you aspired to buy, which political parties you joined, the freedom to choose who you were. Viktor Orbán was just 25 years old when he made his first impression on Hungarians at a rally in Budapest, 5 months before the wall came down. The purpose of the rally was to rebury the corpse of the martyred Imre Nagy, the man who led Hungary during its 1956 uprising against Soviet rule. Nagy, the communist prime minister, had embraced the uprising, called for multi-party democracy, declared Hungary's neutrality in the Cold War, and demanded an end to Soviet military occupation. In a scene analogous to that in Tiananmen Square a few decades later, Soviet tanks rolled into Budapest, crushing the uprising, killing thousands, and displacing hundreds of thousands more. Nagy was hanged, his body discarded in a prisoner's grave. At the time of the 1989 rally, Orbán was a young beneficiary of the wealthy Hungarian-American emigre, George Soros. As the leader of the Federation of Young Democrats, Orbán represented the demands of Hungarian youth tieless, his dark hair in the style of a 1980s lead singer. He stood in front of four microphones in a crowd of 100,000 people. Orbán paid tribute to the fact that Nagy identified himself with the wishes of the Hungarian nation to put an end to the communist taboos, blind obedience to the Russian Empire, and the dictatorship of a single party. Orbán himself was strident and uncompromising in his own defiance. Orbán was a very popular liberal politician back then, Sándor told me. Listening to him recall those days, I remembered my wonder at the images I watched on television as a 12-year-old in New York City, of the crowds of Europeans filling the streets of fallen imperial capitals. I believed that what they wanted was simple. They wanted freedom. And that meant that America, in my young boy's mind, was winning. The winds of change. This was freedom's high watermark. In a dizzying few years, the communist regimes of Eastern Europe collapsed, followed by the Soviet Union. Nelson Mandela strode out of a South African prison. Right-wing dictatorships tumbled from South America to Southeast Asia, no longer a useful extension of American anti-communism. The organizing principle of American politics disappeared as well. The Cold War, which had driven everything from our ascent to the moon, to the structure of our government, to the pop culture that shaped my worldview through osmosis. Bill Clinton was elected, the first American president born after World War II, who melded together center-left policies with accommodation to the unregulated wealth-creating markets unleashed by the collapse of the Iron Curtain. When the Cold War ended, Orbán was, in some ways, an American creation, an underdog and vessel for the same arguments American presidents had been making for decades, a beneficiary of the American policy of containment that compressed the communist bloc into a pressure cooker, overheated by its own corruption and hypocrisy. Today, the anti-corruption organization that Sándor leads, along with many other civil society organizations, has been deemed an enemy of the state by the government of Prime Minister Viktor Orbán. Meanwhile, Orbán has become what he once railed against, obedient to Russia, the corrupt beneficiary of the dark money that courses through the veins of global markets, leader of what increasingly resembles a dictatorship by a single party. The story of how that happened is the story of how the period after that high watermark of freedom failed to reconcile the wounds of the past or offer people a sense of purpose for the future. It's a story that shaped the lives of Hungarians like Viktor Orbán and Sándor Lederer in very different ways. At the time, the fall of the Berlin Wall seemed to end the historical epic that had begun with the rise of fascism and communism. The carnage of World War II had morphed into the competition between capitalist democracy and communist autocracy. And now that battle was over. As an American, I believed we had all emerged into a new consensus, the benevolent cocoon of American-led globalization. But within Europe, the early 20th century clashes over identity cast long shadows. After the Iron Curtain was lifted, the shadows were still there, within nations, communities, and individual lives. Sándor is a half-Jewish Hungarian whose family circle encompasses the various conflicts and contradictions of the 20th century. He was born in a country that suffered under the rule of Nazi-backed Hungarian fascists during World War II and Russian-backed communists during the Cold War. His Jewish grandparents on his father's side met in exile in Turkey during World War II. During the war, Sándor's grandmother, who was born in the Ukrainian city of Odessa, worked for Soviet intelligence. Sándor's grandfather, horrified by what was happening in Europe, worked for the British Secret Services. After the war, Sándor's grandparents moved to Budapest, where they were generally loyal to the new Soviet-backed system. For them, Sándor said, I think the communist rule was a safeguard that Nazism could not come back. Politics was a question of red or brown, communist or Nazi. As a child, Sándor was preoccupied with the Holocaust. He wasn't religious, but he was acutely aware that he would have been marked for the death camps. "It's still a lesson from history that shapes my thinking," he said. "How such a tragedy can happen in a civilized world as Europe was in the first half of the 20th century." During his time in Germany as a child, Sándor used to take a particular interest in the older buildings, whose timelessness seemed to represent something sturdy and lasting from the past. He'd look around and wonder how it was that a country that was in many ways the center of Western civilization could produce such evil, supported explicitly or implicitly by the people who'd lived in those old buildings. As I am half Jewish and secular myself, it's not surprising that this question used to gnaw at my American mind as a child as well, even though I was insulated by the distance of an ocean. Sándor grew up wary of the dark places that charismatic political leaders can take nations. So his heroes were not politicians, but ordinary people. Victor Kugler and Johannes Kleinman, the two Dutchmen who helped hide Anne Frank and her family in that small annex to an apartment during the Nazi occupation of Holland. "I never really liked authority and celebrities and stars and these kinds of heroes," Sándor told me. "And for me, these two guys were powerful examples of risking their own lives, risking their own well-being, to protect a family that was in danger because they were Jewish. It made no difference that none of the people in this drama were Hungarian. What we need in society are such people," he said. Yet as Sándor moved through school in 1990s Budapest, he noticed how Hungarians avoided the minefields of the 20th century. Some Hungarians had supported the Nazi collaborating government that sent hundreds of thousands of Jews to their death. Others, like Sándor's family, had supported the communists who kept a tight lid on Hungary for more than four decades. "We did not really deal with it," he said. "Teachers were afraid to touch these topics or speak out on this, because immediately students brought up their family stories. Because every family could look back on this, we were victims of the Nazis. We were benefiting from the communists. We were benefiting from the Nazis taking flats from the Jews. So instead of having these debates, the teachers, I think, always wanted to share the minimum, the dates and people involved, and just to have a timeline of history, but not really the interesting stuff." In this way, instead of forging a renewed sense of national identity after the experience of the Cold War, one that exorcised its ghosts and replaced them with something different, the newly free Hungary avoided the matter of identity, what it meant to be Hungarian in the political sense. That was something private, tied to the painful past. Globalization was the new identity on offer from the American victors of the Cold War. Expanding markets, opening societies, and liberal democracy washing over Eastern Europe like the rushing water of a breaking wave before it recedes. As Sándor moved through school, Viktor Orbán began his transformation from liberal firebrand to reactionary. There was a crowded slate of parties on the left, and Orbán's own party, Fidesz, performed poorly in elections. So he pulled his party to the right, embracing at first a conventional form of center-right politics: smaller government, market-friendly, socially conservative. He served an unremarkable term as prime minister from 1998 to 2002, and was then voted out. Over the next 8 years, Orbán turned his political party into a social movement, organizing civic circles across the country. The civic circles were small gatherings of people, often centered in churches, that cemented a longing for a traditional set of values rooted in a lost Hungarian identity. A Hungary that was Christian, a Hungary with an ancient past, a brotherhood rooted in patriotism and shared grievances. Orbán reached back to the time before the Cold War, and even before World War II. He highlighted the historic humiliation of the Treaty of Trianon, which dismembered Hungary at the end of World War I, costing it two-thirds of its territory and stranding millions of ethnic Hungarians beyond newly drawn borders. Here was a history that many Hungarians could agree upon. But it was also the same blood-and-soil form of European nationalism that had ravaged the continent during World War II and killed hundreds of thousands of people in the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. A nationalism that implicitly excused the ideology of fascism while rebuking the more recent evil of communism. Orbán's politics didn't always fit neatly on the West-left-right spectrum. Many of his supporters from the civic circles joined the global protests against the Iraq War in 2003, embracing anti-war rhetoric that, rightly, cast the American occupation of an Arab country as a form of imperialism that discredited the entire American-led international order. As the decade marched on toward the financial crisis of 2008, Orbán attacked amoral multinational corporations and the neoliberalism that fueled their profits, along with widening inequality between individuals and nations. In this way, Orbán's identity-based nationalism drew upon resentment of two fundamental pillars of the post-Cold War American order: the unequal wealth creation of open markets and the unchecked excesses of American military power. At the same time, Orbán began to expropriate themes from the Republican Party's culture wars within American society: fidelity to Christian values, opposition to abortion and LGBT rights, antipathy to crass popular culture, and resentment of the political correctness of elites. To many Hungarians, the first two decades after the fall of the Berlin Wall had been disorienting and disappointing. The nation was wealthier, but that wealth was still far behind that of its Western European neighbors, and it was concentrated more in the hands of faceless corporations and a small elite than in those of individual Hungarians. The nation was a member of clubs like NATO and the European Union, but it lacked the clout to have a voice on foolish American projects like the invasion of Iraq. The nation was free, but to many, the liberated culture seemed designed to offend more traditional Christian sensibilities. In response, Orbán wasn't just leading a political party. He was building a movement rooted in a deeper sense of national identity, offering a seawall of protection against the encroaching tides of globalization. To do that, he planted a foot on one side of that unresolved divide between red and brown, communism and fascism, in Hungarian history. He was a nationalist, and he was poised to make Hungary great again. Around the same time, in the mid-2000s, Sándor had a very different kind of political awakening. He was finishing university with plans to be a diplomat when he noticed that one of his favorite parts of Budapest was being systematically destroyed. The 7th District, a neighborhood of pleasantly worn-in 19th-century buildings with balconies and long courtyards, housing a teeming mix of people from different classes, backgrounds, and ethnicities. It was also Hungary's old Jewish quarter, the neighborhood where Jews had been pushed into ghettos toward the end of Nazi dominance. That distinctive charm and resonant history, he noticed, was being replaced by new buildings without any character. The stale sameness not of communism, but of utilitarian capitalism. Ugly, irrelevant buildings, Sándor told me, that could be anywhere in the world. It was not hard for me to understand why Sándor might have a visceral reaction to this cultural erasure. Like Sándor's, my Jewish roots are in the Eastern European countries, where pogroms drove people deep into the Jewish quarters of the grand cities. A good chunk of my family came to America early, decades before German nationalism lit the fires that fueled the Holocaust, while some stayed behind, destined to be surrounded by walls. Growing up in New York City, I did not feel my Jewishness as a religious identity. History was something we had escaped from. Our rabbis were writers, Roth, Bellow, Singer, who told stories from the residue of nation states, the assertion of the individual. our temples were the apartment buildings, courtyards, and fire escapes of Manhattan, where every life contained multitudes. As unbridled capitalism washed across New York at the same time that it remade Budapest, I had felt Sandor's sense of loss as I watched characterless glass towers erase those old apartment buildings, and with them, the stories they held. While Orban was starting his civic circles, Sandor decided to investigate what was remaking this neighborhood he cared about. It wasn't hard to find a paper trail around the real estate transactions, or to figure out the larger context. The people kicked out of their old apartments received little compensation. The developers made a lot of money putting up these larger, uglier buildings. The politicians funded their campaigns and probably made something on the side from the developers. It was not simply ignorance or lack of culture, he told me. It was mainly corruption. Very typical. I think you have these stories all around the world. When Sandor graduated from university, he decided to do something about it. Together with two friends, he started K-Monitor, an organization dedicated to combating corruption and promoting transparency and accountability in politics. They had no money. They worked, Sandor said, like a garage band, out of a worn-down house that one of his friend's parents owned on the outskirts of Budapest. They collected data and created a database mapping corruption across the country. The internet was essential to their work. Ultimately, their database grew to include more than 50,000 articles. They began to raise funds and receive grants. In keeping with the grassroots egalitarian ethos of the organization, Sandor insisted on paying each employee the same amount, himself included. In their different ways, Orban and Sandor were both reacting to a sense in the broader society that the economy and politics were increasingly corrupted. And there was ample evidence to justify that feeling. At the same time that K-Monitor was formed in 2006, confidence in the center-left government collapsed when the recently re-elected prime minister, Ferenc Gyurcsány, was secretly recorded giving a speech to party elites in which he acknowledged, obviously, we lied throughout the last year and a half, 2 years. We lied morning, noon, and night. He was referring in part to a refusal to tell the truth in the last campaign about austerity measures that would be needed because of the excess government spending that seemed to have benefited mostly those at the top. If there is a scandal in the society, he lamented, it's the fact that the upper 10,000 are building themselves up again using public money. As if anticipating the coming direction of events, he implored the left that it doesn't have to hang its head in this fucking country, that we shouldn't shit ourselves in fear of Viktor Orban and the right. The prime minister had committed the political sin of stating the truth, confirming a sense in the country that the government was dishonest, corrupt, and powerless against the forces of globalization shaping life in Hungary. The streets exploded in protest. There were riots at the national television station and in front of the parliament building. Sandor recalls being unsettled by the instability. He could understand the anger, but it seemed that Orban was inciting the protests. The far right was taking over the streets, and the police did little to assert control. You see the police cars in the neighboring street, and you see some policemen coming up, but they are just pushed away by the crowds, the far right crowds. There were many skinheads and right wing radicals, and somehow the government is unable to stop it. From his perch as leader of Fidesz, Orban fueled this dynamic with provocative talk about who was a real Hungarian and who was not. The competition between red and brown that had gone unresolved in Sandor's classroom was now being pursued in the streets. Meanwhile, in those early years of K-Monitor, Sandor told me they learned a basic truth. Political corruption is very much connected to political finance. In the post-Soviet bloc, the financing of politics was poorly regulated. If I want to put it in a nice way, Sandor said, it made politicians become corrupt because they do this to be able to fund campaigns. They had to get the money from somewhere. Once parties like Fidesz won elections at the local level, they also started funneling public money into their campaigns. K-Monitor saw some results in its anti-corruption work. Local politicians were shamed, and national corruption scandals were a feature of campaigns. But nobody was vigorously prosecuted because everyone had similar clouds hanging over them. This proved corrosive to Hungarian politics and society, as ordinary Hungarians became more cynical about the whole enterprise of democracy, which was, after all, less than 2 decades old. Many Hungarians recall Orbán's rise by citing the Hungarian flag cockades that Fidesz members started to wear on their clothes, which recalled for me the ubiquitous American flag lapel pins that appeared on the suit jackets of American politicians after 9/11. In America, national fervor about terrorism had been marshaled by the Bush administration to replace the sense of purpose that we once had found in opposing communism during the Cold War. In Hungary, national fervor was marshaled by Orbán to fill the chasm that had opened up after the end of the Cold War. Only the enemies were the forces of globalization encroaching from abroad and his political opponents at home. In 2008, the bottom fell out of the global economy after American-made financial schemes triggered the financial crisis. Hungary was hit particularly hard, with one of the most open economies in Europe and without the deep reserves of capital that allowed Americans to avoid collapse on a similar scale. Because of foreign debts and its swollen budget deficits, Hungary was forced to turn to the International Monetary Fund to stabilize its finances, a dynamic that added humiliation to the economic injury. The already discredited government had no levers to pull to stimulate growth. Banks wouldn't lend. Investment dried up. People couldn't pay their debts. Jobs were lost. Wages stagnated. The ads on billboards showed things that people couldn't afford. The unattainable spoils of liberal democracy. The political parties on television were helpless to deliver them. The people lost confidence in the entire system of the post-Cold War world. Democracy and capitalism, globalization and the American-led order, which now appeared as corrupted as an old neighborhood being wrecked for a dubious real estate deal, or a politician admitting to lies in a secret recording, a soulless exercise that created wealth for the wealthy with no anchor in morality. Perhaps the post-Cold War system was no better than what came before, a pyramid scheme to protect the interests of the powerful. Orbán was ready for that moment. He was already the leading opposition figure, and as Hungary plunged into a debt spiral and people lost their savings, he swept to a massive electoral victory in 2010. Orbán had completed his transformation from a young liberal politician to a far-right nationalist, with the political project rooted in Hungary's older history. "It's definitely a cut between 1989 and 2010, Sándor told me. Beginning in 2010, Orbán would set about remaking Hungary, claiming as a mandate the failure of the period that went before. The economic crisis was a main driver that change could happen, so 2010 was more than a change in government." Viktor Orbán and Sándor Lederer both formed their political identities in response to the shortcomings of the post-Cold War era, the failure of the American-led order to replace the ghosts of the past with a tangible sense of meaning. Both of them lamented globalization's bloodless encroachment on certain aspects of Hungarian identity. Both of them found a foil in a government that had become too comfortable with the soiled compromises of corrupted democratic governance. Orbán's instinct was to pursue power by directing people to the currents of national identity and historical grievance left dormant and unaddressed beneath the surface of Hungarian life. Like an underground river, the politics of red or brown. Sándor's impulse was to protect something he loved in his community and to search for ways to hold those in power accountable, like the ordinary people who'd been his heroes. Both of them were defending things from the past that needed to be protected. But whereas Chandor was pursuing activism against the unjust use of political and economic power, Orban was methodically pursuing political and economic power. What he did when he attained it not only transformed Hungary, it joined a wave of right-wing nationalism that would reshape the world. 3. Take our country back, from Trianon to the Tea Party. I've written thousands of speeches for Barack Obama. Many were box-checking exercises to one constituency or another. But every now and then, circumstances align that allow the words of a politician to speak to something bigger that is happening in the society at large, the yearning for some sense of direction. In 2008, over a few hours on laptops in hotel rooms, lobbies, in a car on darkened backroads, Jon Favreau and I wrote a speech for Obama to give after the New Hampshire primary, which we assumed he would win after his resounding victory in the Iowa caucus. The speech's crescendo would be a long riff, punctuated by the declaration, "Yes, we can." Obama lost. He delivered the speech anyway. It worked better coming from someone who just lost, returned to the status of underdog. And it met the moment for an America repelled by the Bush years, turned off by the more of the same odor that clouded Hillary Clinton's candidacy, and thirsting for something new. It worked because the words met a moment that had already been building and were spoken by someone who sounded authentic when he said them. Obama's speech represented his own story and the sweep of American progressive politics that made his story possible. Black people, workers, disaffected youth, anyone who ever looked at power as something that excluded them. On July 26, 2014, Viktor Orban gave a speech about the end of liberal democracy and the ascendance of a new nationalist and illiberal movement. "What we should view as our starting point," he said, "is the great redistribution of global financial, economic, commercial, political, and military power that became obvious in 2008. It had been the starting point of a new political project, but one that was more focused on consolidating Orban's own power than remedying the inequities of the global economy. By then, the fiery young anti-communist had been replaced by a stout 55-year-old man with the carefully coiffed gray hair of a banker. He was speaking at the beginning of his second consecutive term as prime minister, but he wasn't speaking in Hungary. He was addressing a meeting of ethnic Hungarians in neighboring Romania. Like the European nationalist of the early 20th century, Orban had made the concept of a broader ethnic Hungarian nation central to his political project. Tapping into historical grievance, borders redrawn after the humiliation of World War I, Hungarians stranded within other nations. That was, quite literally, his audience. In 2014, Orban knew that he had reached that kind of moment. He declared that his government's ascendance constituted regime change and had to be viewed as part of a global phenomenon. There were three great changes in the global regime during the 20th century, he argued. At the end of the First World War, at the end of the Second World War, and in 1990. The joint characteristic of these is that when these changes occurred, it was clear to everybody, from practically one day to the next, that from now on, they would be living in a different world from the one they had been living in until then. Just as Obama was the right man to defiantly proclaim, "Yes, we can," Orban was the right man to make the argument for global regime change from the perspective of his own country. He had been on the front lines at the end of the Cold War, only to capitalize on the failure of that moment to deliver on its promise. A failure embodied in the 2008 financial crisis. The significance of this change is not quite so obvious, he acknowledged. At the time of the Great Western Financial Collapse in 2008, it was not clear that we would be living in a different world from now on. The change is not as acute as in the case of the first three great global regime changes, but it somehow effuses our minds at a slower pace. And just as the fog slowly settles on the landscape, we slowly grasp the knowledge that if we take a good look around and properly analyze everything going on around us, then this is a different world. Standing in the heart of Europe, Orbán suggested that the time of looking west for leadership was over. The future, he suggested in words that would have been unthinkable a decade earlier, belonged to systems that are not Western, not liberal, not liberal democracies, and perhaps not even democracies. He name-checked Russia and China as two stars of this emerging cosmos. Even as Orbán spoke, the American Republican Party was attacking the wiring of America's own democracy as aggressively as Orbán was remaking Hungary's. How did that happen? And what was it all about? To answer those questions, you have to understand how Orbán redefined Hungary as the fog settled on the post-2008 landscape. When you do, you begin to see a mirror image of what has happened in the United States. Orbán's party didn't just win in 2010. It captured a two-thirds majority in parliament, which gave Orbán free rein to mold the Hungarian polity like a lump of clay. More than 1,000 laws were passed during his first few years in office, usually with little debate. Many of the most important laws were not about solving problems, but about power. This included an overhaul of the Constitution in 2011. Election laws were changed. Voting rights were extended to ethnic Hungarians living beyond Hungary's borders. The number of members of parliament was cut in half, and parliamentary districts were redrawn for the benefit of Orbán's party, Fidesz. The courts were changed. The retirement age of judges was lowered in order to open up more slots for Orbán's party to fill. And the selection of judges was handed over to a single person named by Orbán to a 9-year term. Hungary's constitutional court, its version of the U.S. Supreme Court, was thus turned into a body that would reliably decide in favor of Orbán's government. The distribution of economic power was changed. Instead of taming the power of big business, Orbán co-opted it. Billions of dollars in economic assistance from the European Union were funneled to contracts that enriched Orbán's cronies. One close friend of Orbán's from his home village, Lőrinc Mészáros, went from gasfitter to billionaire. "That I have been able to come so far," he said. "God, luck, and the person of Viktor Orbán have certainly played a role." The cronies who benefited from this corrupt largesse then funded Orbán's politics. To understand how a mix of state power and corrupt cronies could remake Hungarian society, you need only look at the Hungarian media. In Budapest, I sat down with Zsabolcs Panyi, a dogged investigative journalist. I wanted to understand what had happened from the perspective of someone who had both covered this corruption and been on the receiving end of it. Both Orbán and his lieutenants at Fidesz were complaining for a long time, Zsabolcs told me, just like in the U.S., that the media is dominated by the leftist liberal conglomerate, that most of the mainstream media outlets are just inherently hostile towards them. So they had this clear mission to balance out the media landscape. America, the country that had once been the emblem of a free press, had offered the example of the original Fox News slogan, which suggested that elevating right-wing viewpoints was an end in itself, fair and balanced. Orbán transformed what news the Hungarian people consume, and therefore what reality they live within. Some steps were straightforward. The National Communications and Media Authority, which oversaw the sector, was filled with Fidesz appointees and given broad powers to punish outlets that engaged in coverage deemed unbalanced or threatening to common morals. It became harder for independent broadcasting stations to get licenses, and the state-supported media were pulled to the right. nearly 1,000 people were forced to leave their public broadcasting jobs. First, the public media was turned into government media. Fire people, completely restructure it. They get tons of government money, and just in some years, it became a really low-quality propaganda vehicle, Jabolcs said. Beyond that, Orbán also saw that many Hungarian media outlets were dependent on government-associated advertising from entities ranging from the lottery to the National Energy Company. So he cut off government advertising for left-wing or liberal outlets and channeled all of the money into the right-wing media. Once his crony network was established, Orbán's tactics became more aggressive. Around 2013 and 2014, Jabolcs told me, these huge buy-ups started. At the same time that right-wing media were being given preferential treatment, these government proxies, businessmen, bought up first the second largest privately owned TV station, and then they went after newspapers and other TV and radio stations. Sometimes, the newly purchased media entities were pulled to the right. Sometimes, they were simply shut down. Since technically these were individuals buying it, Jabolcs said, Orbán and his people could say, we have nothing to do with the media. These are private citizens investing, blah, blah, blah. One of the newspapers that was purchased and shut down was the one where Sándor Lederer's father had worked for decades. When complaints were raised about the decision, the Orbán government pointed out that an Austrian company, not the Hungarian government, had bought the newspaper. Left unsaid was the fact that the company was tied to right-wing interests, close to Orbán. Within just a few years, Orbán could count on compliant media to tell his story. In vast swaths of Hungary, where there are only a few television stations and local newspapers, the voice of Fidesz is now omnipresent. You have the pro-government sphere, Jabolcs said, where most of the readers and listeners are from the countryside, where there's no alternative, for example, to local newspapers. And all of Hungary's local newspapers, print newspapers, are owned by the same right-wing conglomerate. Jabolcs had worked at one of Hungary's largest online outlets, Index, which was recently sold to a Fidesz proxy that promptly fired much of its staff and eventually shut it down. Since 2018, Jabolcs has worked for a website called Direct 36. 36 is Hungary's telephone code, which reaches a largely cosmopolitan Budapest elite and people outside the country. Direct 36 relies in large part on reader donations, in part because of American creations that shape how human beings around the globe receive information. Google, Facebook, Jabolcs said, referring to the American companies that offer the platforms where readers find online articles, are stealing all the advertisements from online media. Orbán doesn't need to shut down these islands of independent journalism entirely, because he can largely drown them out with his propaganda machine. When I asked Jabolcs if journalists were subjected to physical intimidation or harassment, he said no. He could freely do his work. But that work was routinely attacked by the much larger government-friendly media enterprises. It's quite frequent that they name and shame journalists, he told me. The goals are one, try and discredit them, because there are still a lot of people listening to independent journalists, because what this right-wing conglomerate is giving them is basically bullshit. The aim, Jabolcs said, is to cast some doubt that what they are reading is also partisan. It's influenced by George Soros. You know, there's no reality. There's no facts. It's just opinion. Everything is partisan. If the nation-state was increasingly inseparable from Orbán and the media his mouthpiece, what story was he telling? After all, there was no clear ideological project at the heart of all this, no turn to communism or militarism. There was, instead, Orbán's idea of Hungarian identity, a Christian nation rooted in ethnicity, a traditional society with an assortment of triumphs and grievances. There was, above all, a sense of what Hungary was not, what it was against, to identify who the us were, Orbán focused more